their markets to Western goods. This was followed not only by another American expedition, but by a British expedition in 1854. And after considerable internal turmoil, the Japanese did indeed decide that they had no choice but to open, and indeed, in an unusually constructive reaction, would launch a process of reform that went well beyond simple response to Western demands. Crisis number four, 1854-5, the Russians had successfully achieved another territorial victory over the Ottomans and were poised to pry more Ottoman territory away. Britain and France objected for various reasons, including British fear about increasing Russian interference with British contacts with India, and Britain and France went to war against Russia in the Crimea, essentially literally in Russia's backyard, and although this was not an easy conflict, lots of losses on both sides, the West again won. The power of industrial production, industrial transportation, industrial technology applied to the military area now made it clear that even Russia was clearly behind. And then a series of military explosions and penetrations from the 1860s onward, particularly in Africa, also in additional areas of the Pacific, etc. There were few parts of the world that Europe tried to enter militarily where it failed. The leading one, ironically, was Afghanistan. For most parts of the world, either direct military penetration or the successful threat of this penetration now reshaped the world, at least again briefly, to the West's advantage. This was, of course, the century of imperialism, a familiar label, but it can be taken even more deeply. What happened fundamentally really was a simplification of the world economic patterns we've described previously. Two changes were crucial. One we've touched on already, and that was the intensification of the exploitation of the bulk of the world, not now just parts of the world, but the bulk of the world, by core societies, now increasingly including the United States. But the second change, and here's where the military part comes in, the second change was the effective elimination of externality. No major society could now stay external because the West, through military pressure, if not economic cajoling, simply wouldn't allow it. Thus, societies that had regulated Western contacts previously, like China, now found themselves incapable of maintaining this regulation. Societies that had sought partial isolation previously, like Japan and Korea, now find that they are not allowed to do this either, with a very, very small number of exceptions. The world is open to the Western-dominated world economy for a brief series of decades. In this framework, which really was, if you will, an intensification, a redefinition, but intensification of patterns that had already been sketched to some degree in the early modern period. In this framework, two or three other components get added in the long 19th century that need attention as well. First of all, this was, of course, at least the early part of the long 19th century, not only an age of early industrialization and its global impact, not only an age of new imperialistic military activities, but also an age of Atlantic revolutions. Beginning in the 1770s, a series of risings occurred in various parts of the Atlantic world, in North America, in parts of Western Europe, in Latin America, that would extend from the 1770s on to 1848-49, creating new political regimes, new attention to ideologies of liberty, legal and possibly even social and economic equality, a whole series of new ideological thrusts that brought important new political ideas and concrete illustrations of those ideas into the world stage. It isn't entirely easy to talk about how this other important initiative fully matches the larger framework that was shaped by industrialization and Western military dominance. Because frankly, many of the revolutionary ideals sincerely espoused by Europeans themselves didn't clearly fit the kinds of relationships that Europe was also forging with places in Asia and Africa. After all, if the new battle cry was freedom and political participation, imperialism was a denial of freedom, at least in many respects, and clearly a denial of political participation, so that there was a long lag on a global basis between the emergence of new revolutionary thrusts and truly global impact. Atlantic impact, quite clear, and this is an important aspect of the long 19th century. But global impact, in a way, would turn out to be greater in the 20th century than in the long 19th, because it's in the 20th century that various kinds of revolutionaries and reformers would utilize the ideologies of the revolutionary West or the revolutionary Atlantic world to help spur national independence movements, social revolutions, this sort of thing. So this is a category of developments in the long 19th century. We don't want to forget about it, and we will indeed see one clear impact in our next discussion of slavery and abolitionism, but it doesn't totally fit the patterns that we're indicating. Somewhat more general, and we will return to this one also in greater detail, but we can have a first stab on it now. Somewhat more general was another new global theme, has to be phrased carefully, but I think it's a valid one. Another new global theme of a need to figure out how to respond to the West. Western power by the middle of the 19th century was so palpable, was so unavoidable, that virtually every major society or some segment of it had to begin discussing, what are we going to do about it? How can we get rid of the West, resist the West, and what do we need to change in order to do so? And what do we need to change that might imitate at least aspects of Western development itself for the opportunity to regain or preserve some degree of regional independence? An early illustration of this new sense of a need to change in order to resist the West occurred in the aftermath of Napoleon's invasions, occurred in Egypt, where a new leader in the early 19th century, Muhammad Ali, effectively moved Egypt toward de facto independence from the Ottoman Empire and undertook a path of reform that he hoped would bring industrialization and modern political and economic conditions to Egypt, allowing it to retain independence from the West, which was otherwise clearly threatened. Muhammad Ali sent scores of Egyptian students to European schools to learn engineering, modern science, and other technologies. He sought to encourage Egyptian industry. He sought to encourage new kinds of cash crops in Egyptian agriculture, such as cotton. It was an extremely interesting effort, but it was also extremely interesting that this early attempt largely failed. Western pressure, the limits of resources in Egypt itself, tended to confine the durable results of this reform movement to the production of new cash crops that could serve the world market. Egyptian industrialization was not in the cards at this point, but again, it was a revealing episode. Slightly later, the Ottoman Empire itself would undertake patterns of reform, seeking to redo its constitutional structure, to at least admit some new types of political institutions in the Western model, seeking to streamline its bureaucracy, seeking to create a more efficient, forward-looking bureaucracy, seeking to improve and modernize its educational system. Again, these reform movements, which crested in the late 1830s and again in the 1870s, had mixed results. They were not ungenuine, but they obviously also did not move the Ottoman Empire to a position of reversing its pattern of difficulty in face of Western interference and objections. Russia would launch a major reform movement, beginning with the emancipation of the serfs in 1861, leading not only to this emancipation, but to significant new local political institutions, reforms of Russian law toward a reduction in the severity of punishments, codification of law, efforts to spur industrialization, and by the 1890s, Russia was indeed launched in a significant industrialization process, one of the first such processes to take hold outside of the West proper. Reform, in other words, was in the air. However, and this is where the complexity has to enter in, while I think it is fair to say that world history in the long 19th century, particularly the second half of the long 19th century, is partly framed not just in terms of new Western industrial power and military interference, but in terms of efforts at reform and reaction, it is important to recognize two things. First of all, Western power affected different regions differently. Some were held, like India and increasingly Africa, as outright colonies. Some were simply targets of interference, like China, and people have debated whether it wasn't actually better for a while to be a colony than to be a target of external exploitation, the way China was. European contact varied. So did traditions and 19th century conditions. China, although this is not really totally predictable from earlier Chinese history, China responded slowly and long inadequately to the reform pressure. And only in the 1890s does a real reform movement begin to catch hold in China. This is, again, partly because of traditional resentment of outside interference and models, partly because of the outside interference itself, partly because Chinese governments at this point were exceptionally ineffective in one of those downward spins in the Chinese political process that occurred periodically. This was obviously quite a different response from that of Russia or Japan, a comparison that we'll take up a bit later, and even from the Ottoman Empire. Responses varied, and it is vitally important to recognize this variety and recognize that even at the crest of European power, world history needs to be seen in terms of interactions and not simply imposition. Nowhere, even in its starkest colonial holdings, did the West simply impose conditions on other societies. There were always reactions, always combinations, always resistances. And in this sense, the richness of world history, the need for comparison and variety, continues quite strong, even in a century that in broad outline seems particularly simple, i.e. imperialism and European dominance. One final facet of the long 19th century I think is worth mention, even though, frankly, it's a subordinate theme, and that was the tentative emergence of new kinds of international institutions and arrangements that accompanied industrialization and the increasingly global qualities of the world economy. Let me mention a couple of particularly salient developments. It was soon after the middle of the 19th century, for example, that the Universal Postal Union was formed, a series of agreements dominated by Western players speaking on behalf of the whole world that allowed individual nations to agree on how to transmit mail from one society to the next. We now obviously pretty much take International Postal Service for granted, except in times of chaos or revolution. But it's really only in the later 19th century that this international facility came into being. It was soon after the 1860s as well that the International Red Cross formed. Initially, again, a Western organization primarily, but one that began to help set standards not just for medical activities during wartime, but for broader agreements that other societies would gradually adhere to, that at least on paper sought to regulate some of the worst effects of modern war, particularly in areas such as treatment of the wounded and treatment of prisoners. Other international agreements allowed, obviously, technological developments such as the laying of undersea cables, etc. Western dominated, in one sense, a facet of imperialism itself, the fact that international agreements were beginning to come into being, and one could mention also at the very end of the 19th century, the emergence of a new world court in The Hague. These developments were at least preliminary hints of a partial international political structure that was itself a marked innovation. International connections were also furthered, of course, by the development of not only of new technologies, but of new transportation arrangements, the cutting of two great canals in the long 19th century, first the Suez and then the Panama, were huge developments facilitating international contact and trade. This obviously fits the spread of the world economy model, but it deserves separate notice because, again, you're talking about new kinds of global connections that could go beyond trade. The 1880s, again, toward the end of the long 19th century, the 1880s saw the emergence of a new series of private international non-governmental organizations dealing with issues such as women's rights, white slavery, problems of this sort, and again, we'll touch on some of this in our next session as well. This first spate of what we would now call international NGOs was another sign that people, always first from the West, because the West was the dominant player still, that people were beginning to think in terms of new kinds of international connections that would relate to the world economy, but that would go well beyond it. New patterns of cultural contacts are intriguing at the end of the long 19th century. The first real sign of a new kind, a new potential for what we would now call a global consumer culture emerges in the final decade of the 19th century in the beginnings of the internationalization of several key Western sports, most notably from Britain, soccer, which begins to spread to Latin America, to parts of Asia, and by the 1920s, a little bit after our period, literally the whole world, on its way to becoming the world's most agreed-upon international sport. Also, in the late 19th century, the beginnings of the spread of American baseball to Latin America and the Caribbean, but also to Japan. A Japanese baseball team defeated an American Navy team in the mid-1890s to the great delight of the Japanese, to Korea and elsewhere. These developments, seemingly sort of trivial, are another sign that a final facet of the long 19th century that needs to be noted beneath the surface of exploitation, imperialism, etc., a final facet is the beginnings of the emergence of new kinds of global connections and contacts, some of them institutional, some of them new evidences of international cultural interaction that would gain a life of their own and help shape the next period in world history as well. Let me emphasize finally the brevity of this long 19th century, particularly the extent to which many crucial developments spread not just through the whole long 19th century, but in its final half or two-thirds. This is a story of Western dominance. It is a story of Western economic and military controls that are striking, that make this period, at least superficially, unusually simple. But again, it's also brief. The reason we end the period in 1914, though we'll have to talk about this more in a subsequent discussion, the reason we end this period in 1914 is not just because of the dramatic fact of World War I, but because it was during and as a result of World War I that this kind of easy Western dominance in the world at large began to come to an end. A few decades, very interesting, very important. We live with their legacy still, but a few decades only.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled A Brief History of the World, Part 3. Lecture 25, Abolition of Slavery and Serfdom.
One of the big changes in world history during the long 19th century, actually starting in the late 18th and extending to 1914 and even beyond, was a process through which formal slavery was abolished throughout really the entire world, and attacks were also made on the harshest forms of serfdom, though there were more survivals here. This change deserves attention for several reasons. In the first place, big picture, Slavery, as has been obvious from our discussions, was one of the oldest institutions in human society. Because of capture in war, because of inherited status, because of greedy seizure of other people, even in one's own society, the patterns varied, but the impulse to try to gain ownership over other people and their labor obviously goes deep in the human experience. The century that brought this institution to a close deserves significant attention in this longer perspective. The development in the 19th century also demands attention. In some ways, the abolition of slavery in the 19th century, although of course we know what happened, might seem counterintuitive. After all, in many ways, this was a century in which exploitative economic practices increased, the world economy extended, and with it, efforts to get peripheral societies to produce cheap goods with cheap labor. Obviously, we now have to note that even though the concept of peripheral economies remains valid, as we discussed previously, we now have increasingly to detach it from literally coercive labor, which was one of the definitional characteristics in the early modern period. So what we need to do in charting this really significant change is talk about the issue of causation, particularly given the fact that once we understand slavery's deep roots and understand the exploitative economic relationships that dominate many other aspects of world history in the long 19th century, causation doesn't spring to mind immediately, and almost inevitably it has been much debated. And then after dealing with causation, talk a little bit about the process, because although changes began early, the British, for example, worked to abolish Atlantic slave trade after 1808, although changes began early, the process really stretched through the whole period and, as I've already indicated, slopped over slightly into the 20th century as well. And then we need to talk about consequences, because here too, predictably, although slavery really was abolished and that really is an historical change, the actual consequences were messy, diverse, globally involved, and equally inevitably, the results were perhaps not quite as benign as some of the proponents of abolition might have hoped. The beginnings of arguments against slavery, they weren't brand new in the long 19th century, but the beginnings of arguments against slavery began to take shape particularly coherently in the final decades of the 18th century. Two sources predominated in places like England, the Netherlands, France, Scandinavia, and increasingly some sectors of opinion in British North America. Two sources predominated. First were maverick or new Protestant religious groups, Methodists, for example, and Quakers, particular among them, who used Christianity, as it had not been used in the early modern period, to argue that the enslavement of other people was immoral, improper, and must be ended. Combining with this, sometimes in the same individual, sometimes in separate groups, was the force of Enlightenment thinking, the kind of thinking that went into the revolutionary wave of the late 18th, early 19th centuries as well. Enlightenment arguments could certainly be used against slavery. Enlightenment thinkers tended to stress the fundamental equality of all human beings. They tended to target exploitation, of which slavery was the worst example. They sometimes could add also utilitarian arguments that slavery was not only wrong but inefficient in a society that ought to be bent on more effective motivations for labor and productivity. Agitation in anti-slavery groups took a number of forms. It wasn't a constant force from the late 18th to the early 19th century, but periodically waves of outrage would develop. Huge petitions were signed in England and other places against slavery practices, pressing the British government to act against slavery internationally, and particularly, of course, to act against slavery in the British colonies. These petitions, on occasion, could command an amazing percentage of urban populations, for example, in some of the new factory centers in Great Britain. Along with petitions came efforts to educate larger numbers of people in the evils of slavery. Plays, pamphlets, ultimately, for example, materials, literary materials like Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was widely popularized not only in the United States but also Western Europe. These materials were used to help bring additional people into the anti-slavery crusade. Boycotts were even sketched, although they probably weren't terribly effective, but an interesting tactic in which people were urged to identify goods like sugar that were slave-produced and try to find alternatives. This was a major campaign, and it obviously gradually had effects. The French Revolution added fuel to the fire. French revolutionary principles, obviously building from the Enlightenment, also argued against slavery, and during the radical phase of the revolution, legislation was introduced to abolish slavery in the French colonies. During the 1790s also, the Great Haitian Revolution, which was a revolution both against French colonial control and against slavery, added force to the anti-slavery arguments, obviously illustrating the capacity of former slaves to rise against the institution and build a new society, also possibly increasing fears in slave-owning sectors that protest might attack the institution directly as well if something new was not undertaken. The key innovation in all this, and this is certainly one cause of this huge historical change, the key innovation in all this was what several historians have identified as a new kind of humanitarian thinking, again, could derive from maverick strands of Christianity or the Enlightenment or both. And the key principle here was that moral concern could and should now extend to situations that were distant from one's own, that involved people that were different from oneself, that involve people who might not even share one's own religion. The great world religions had obviously already permitted concern about distant others if they were in your religion, concern about Christians in the Holy Land, concern about conditions among Muslims as other Muslims learned about them on the great pilgrimage to Mecca. But this new humanitarian thinking went even beyond this to suggest a moral responsibility for unjust conditions virtually anywhere in the world, of which slavery now seemed to be the most obvious and the most objectionable. This was an important force, and it had ready audience. The concern about morality also spread to other areas. For example, at the end of the 18th century, some Russian nobles, like a man named Radishev, who had traveled in the West and who knew Enlightenment thinking and sometimes had some familiarity with the French Revolution as well. Thinkers like Radishev wrote convincingly against Russian serfdom on two grounds. First, it was inefficient. Radishev toured the Russian countryside and argued that serfs simply did not work very hard for their masters, but when they were allowed to work on their own plots of land, on Sundays, for example, they worked extremely productively. Russian economy would be better off, so this argument went, if serfdom were abolished. But, again, the moral component was here as well. Regardless of economic efficiency, Radishev argued, Russian serfdom was evil and should be dropped. Radishev's writings were not published. Catherine the Great prevented this. They were indeed published only after the 20th century communist revolution. But the attack was revealing. It showed the potential for certain kinds of thinking that initially developed in the West to spread more broadly. The actual pattern of emancipation and abolition was gradual and varied. The French Revolution, for France itself and for surrounding territories, abolished serfdom permanently in much of Western Europe. The abolition of serfdom would extend into central Germany and Austria through the revolutions of 1848. The institution seemed to be incompatible with modern Enlightenment-style political principles.